File 31.
Only by alliance with England was it possible to safeguard the rear of the new German crusade. The justification for undertaking such an expedition was stronger than the justification which our forefathers had for setting out on theirs. Not one of our pacifists refuses to eat the bread made from the grain grown in the East, and yet the first plough here was that called the sword. No sacrifice should have been considered as too great if it was a necessary means of gaining England's friendship. Colonial and naval ambitions should have been abandoned, and attempts should not have been made to compete against British industries. Only a clear and definite policy could lead to such an achievement. Such a policy would have demanded a renunciation of the endeavour to conquer the world's markets, also a renunciation of colonial intentions and naval power. All the means of power at the disposal of the state should have been concentrated in the military forces on land. This policy would have involved a period of temporary self-denial for the sake of a great and powerful future. There was a time when England might have entered into negotiations with us on the grounds of that proposal, for England would have well understood that the problems arising from the steady increase in population were forcing Germany to look for a solution either in Europe with the help of England, or, without England, in some other part of the world. This outlook was probably the chief reason why London tried to draw nearer to Germany about the turn of the century. For the first time in Germany, an attitude was then manifested which afterwards displayed itself in a most tragic way. People then gave expression to an unpleasant feeling that we might thus find ourselves obliged to pull England's chestnuts out of the fire, as if an alliance could be based on anything else than mutual give and take. And England would have become party to such a mutual bargain. British diplomats were still wise enough to know that an equivalent must be forthcoming as a consideration for any services rendered. Let us suppose that in 1904 our German foreign policy was managed astutely enough to enable us to take the part which Japan played. It is not easy to measure the greatness of the results that might have accrued to Germany from such a policy. There would have been no World War. The blood which would have been shed in 1904 would not have been a tenth of that shed from 1914 to 1918. And what a position Germany would hold in the world today. In any case, the alliance with Austria was then an absurdity. For this mummy of a state did not attach itself to Germany for the purpose of carrying through a war, but rather to maintain a perpetual state of peace, which was meant to be exploited for the purpose of slowly but persistently exterminating the German element in the dual monarchy. Another reason for the impossible character of this alliance was that nobody could expect such a state to take an active part in defending German national interests, seeing that it did not have sufficient strength and determination to put an end to the policy of de-Germanization within its own frontiers. If Germany herself was not moved by a sufficiently powerful national sentiment, and was not sufficiently ruthless to take away from that absurd Habsburg state the right to decide the destinies of 10 million inhabitants, who were of the same nationality as the Germans themselves, surely it was out of the question to expect the Habsburg state to be a collaborating party in any great and courageous German undertaking. The attitude of the old Reich towards the Austrian question might have been taken as a test of its stamina for the struggle where the destinies of a whole nation were at stake. In any case, the policy of oppression against the German population in Austria should not have been allowed to be carried on and to grow stronger from year to year, for the value of Austria as an ally could be assured only by upholding the German element there. But that, of course, was not followed. Nothing was dreaded so much as the possibility of an armed conflict. But finally, and at a most unfavourable moment, the conflict had to be faced and accepted. They thought to cut loose from the cords of destiny, but destiny held them fast. They dreamt of maintaining a world peace and woke up to find themselves in a world war. And that dream of peace was a most significant reason why the above-mentioned third alternative for the future development of Germany was not even taken into consideration. The fact was recognized that new territory could be gained only in the east. But this meant that they would be fighting ahead, whereas they wanted peace at any cost. The slogan of German foreign policy at one time used to be the use of all possible means for the maintenance of the German nation. Now it has changed to maintenance of world peace by all possible means. We know what the result was. I shall resume the discussion of this point in detail later on. There remained still another alternative, which we may call the fourth. This was industry and world trade, naval power and colonies. Such a development might certainly have been attained more easily and more rapidly. To colonize a territory is a slow process, often extending over centuries. Yet this fact is the source of its inner strength, for it is not through a sudden burst of enthusiasm that it can be put into effect, but rather through a gradual and enduring process of growth, quite different from industrial progress, which can be urged on by advertisement within a few years. The result thus achieved, however, is not of lasting quality, but something frail, like a soap bubble. It is much easier to build quickly than to carry through the tough task of settling a territory with farmers and establishing farmsteads. But the former is more quickly destroyed than the latter. In adopting such a course, Germany must have known that to follow it would necessarily mean war sooner or later. Only children could believe that sweet and unctuous expressions of goodness and persistent avowals of peaceful intentions could get them their bananas through this friendly competition between the nations, with the prospect of never having to fight for them. No. Once we had taken this road, England was bound to be our enemy at some time or other to come. Of course, it fitted in nicely with our innocent assumptions, but still it was absurd to grow indignant at the fact that a day came when the English took the liberty of opposing our peaceful penetration with the brutality of violent egoists. Naturally, we on our side would never have done such a thing. If a European territorial policy against Russia could have been put into practice, only in case we had England as our ally, on the other hand, the colonial and world trade policy could have been carried into effect only against English interests and with the support of Russia. But then this policy should have been adopted in full consciousness of all the consequences it involved, and above all things, Austria should have been discarded as quickly as possible. At the turn of the century, the alliance with Austria had become a veritable absurdity from all points of view. But nobody thought of forming an alliance with Russia against England, just as nobody thought of making England an ally against Russia. For in either case, the final result would inevitably have meant war. and to avoid war was the very reason why a commercial and industrial policy was decided upon. It was believed that the peaceful conquest of the world by commercial means provided a method which would permanently supplant the policy of force. Occasionally, however, there were doubts about the efficiency of this principle, especially when some quite incomprehensible warnings came from England now and again. That was the reason why the fleet was built. It was not for the purpose of attacking or annihilating England, but merely to defend the concept of world peace mentioned above, and also to protect the principle of conquering the world by peaceful means. Therefore, this fleet was kept within modest limits, not only as regards the number and tonnage of the vessels, but also in regard to their armament, the idea being to furnish new proofs of peaceful intentions. The chatter about the peaceful conquest of the world by commercial means was probably the most completely nonsensical stuff ever raised to the dignity of a guiding principle in the policy of a state. This nonsense became even more foolish when England was pointed out as a typical example to prove how the thing could be put into practice. Our doctrinal way of regarding history and our professional ideas in that domain have done irreparable harm and offer a striking proof of how people learn history without understanding anything of it. As a matter of fact, England ought to have been looked upon as a convincing argument against the theory of Pacific conquest of the world by commercial means. No nation prepared the way for its commercial conquests more brutally than England did by means of the sword, and no other nation has defended such conquests more ruthlessly. Is it not a characteristic quality of British statecraft that it knows how to use political power in order to gain economic advantages, and inversely, to turn economic conquests into political power? What an astounding error it was to believe that England would not have the courage to give its own blood for the purposes of its own economic expansion. The fact that England did not possess a national army proved nothing, for it is not the actual military structure of the moment that matters, but rather the will and determination to use whatever military strength is available. England has always had the armament which she needed. She always fought with those weapons which were necessary for success. She sent mercenary troops to fight as long as mercenaries sufficed, but she never hesitated to draw heavily and deeply from the best blood of the whole nation when victory could be obtained only by such a sacrifice. And in every case the fighting spirit, dogged determination, and use of brutal means in conducting military operations have always remained the same.